Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subject we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Good afternoon and happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. And you know, I'm really losing my reluctance about the grandmother part of our introduction.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, you know, my granddaughter, she's getting to her three-month-old stage. Last Friday, I woke up in the morning, I thought, oh my gosh, I need to see that baby. And I got in the car and I drove to San Francisco and spent the afternoon just loving on her and gave her a bath at night and put her down. Then I got up Saturday morning and drove home.
It's nice that she's so close.
It's almost 4 hours, but yeah, it feels close because
I
like
she's
driving.
Not in Chicago or something.
No, she's not in Chicago like my other baby.
Right.
But I had been bitten by the bug when I woke up Friday morning and I was on the road. So I am officially owning the grandmotherhood, which is a fabulous thing. And the other thing I observed, and more today so than the drive up north, but there's, you know, we're in a winter of weather, and there's a lot of rain when I went up on Friday, and I'm used to driving in it because I'm old. But it occurred to me today when I was driving into the studio that there are a lot of people on the road who have had their license. They haven't had their license long enough to have ever driven in rain. And they were with me on the road today.
Yeah.
And it shows. I was being passed by young people in small cars going 75 and texting. And it's been pouring. So, you know, the grandmother in me is saying, slow down. Or we need to maybe have a revisit to the how to drive in inclement weather piece.
Yeah. Or have them spend a winter in Buffalo or something.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, you know, the East Coast is having a mild winter. So
yeah,
who knows where you can go to catch some snow. But anyway, there's a couple of things that have been ruminating on my mind, as well as today's topic, which has to do with awakening, tapping into our inner activist, and how do we find those passions, and what separates us from those who actually go on to inspire great change, right? To lead movements, to change laws, to stand up for the oppressed. You know, what separates them from us? Because my sense is that a great many of us have strong passions for different causes. I can't think of any of my acquaintances, friends, or colleagues that don't have strong feelings and passions for different causes or things that they care about. And so I often wonder, you know, what does it take to become that person of change? And of course, the great inspiration for that is yesterday's celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and I'm not making it make sense, but anyway, our day of recognition of all that he accomplished throughout his life. And so it got me thinking about how he came to this place of being so instrumental in change, and not just in the civil rights movement, but he spoke out for 20 years on all sorts of different social justice issues. And how did he get to this place? Because I don't think anyone ever sets out to be the leader of a cause. I mean, maybe some people have high aspirations, maybe to political office or to lead companies. I mean, there are a lot of people that are driven by leadership skills, and I understand that. But I don't know if many people would wake up and say, I want to be the leader of a movement, because there's a lot of pain that goes along with giving over of your life to a cause of some sort. I mean, imagine all of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. had to face throughout his lifetime to get to the place where change happened. And some would argue not enough change, but the change that did occur over the course of his lifetime. What were the sacrifices that he made, the compromises that he had to make, to the stress on his mental health and well-being, the stress on his family? So I'm wondering today how ordinary people find that path to activism. And not just on the national scale, because there are so many different levels of activism. It can be on a national scale, but it can also be in communities. What brings about the people who bring about, who inspires the people who bring out community change? And what about just within families? How do we find the energy, the courage, the strength to bring about change in our families when things aren't going well and people within the family are struggling, or for generations a family might be struggling? Who is that person that steps in and makes that change? How does that happen? So That's what we're going to explore today. I'm going to be curious to know what calls you. What are those issues, those causes that call to you, that drag you into service, or that you try to avoid being dragged into service for? What are your passions? What is that thing that at cocktail parties or afternoons out with friends or gatherings with others that you can't wait to have a conversation about? I'm looking forward to hearing from you later in the show today. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we do gather every Tuesday to talk about those things that go on in our lives and the ways that our mental health and well-being are supported or compromised, the ways we struggle or we thrive. And I do invite you to be part of the conversation in many ways. You can call in 805-781-3875. You can find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Like the page and you'll get updates of what the show topics are each week. Sometimes I post pictures of my guests and what's going on. We have a website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can podcast our shows by going to iTunes and just typing in The Reluctant Therapist, and our podcast will pop up. You can subscribe and then you never miss a show. It'll be downloaded to your devices. And then you also have the opportunity or the option to go to kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. We're right at the top there. Click on it and previous shows from the last 3 years or 4 years pop up, and you can listen to them all, share them with friends. But do be part of the conversation. You can also email me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I love to hear your thoughts, and I do understand that going on the air is not for everyone, and I appreciate that and can empathize. But if you'd like to have your voice be heard and you can't quite get on the air, send me an email or always call in, and Jordan's happy to talk to you and pass along whatever thoughts you have. All right. So enough of the business. Now let's get down to the topic today. And again, I started off thinking about MLK Jr. and why we had the day off yesterday and what kind of things we should be thinking about as a country or as individuals. But then I started thinking out past just one way to be active, and started thinking about those maybe not smaller activists in our lives, but all the ways that we can be activists without having to take on a whole national issue. As I mentioned, you know, there's been people who have brought about great change within the world over the course of our lifetimes and through the beginning of history. And quite often what we'll find that there are things that are similar about all of these ordinary activists. And the thing that links them all together is that all of them were reluctant to go on this path, that they didn't jump in and volunteer or raise their hands and say, let me take this issue on. That most often they were living their lives in quiet ways and were drawn into service in a big way, and had to make choices and sacrifices along the way to make things happen. One of the people that comes to mind is Rachel Carson, the writer and scientist and ecologist who wrote Silent Spring. And I was reading a little bit about her, and she really primarily was hired by the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries. She wrote radio scripts during the Depression. She was primarily a writer and a scientist. She wrote articles on natural history. She worked as a scientist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She wrote pamphlets on conservation. But then after her published one of her books that she published, Help Your Child in Wonder and Our Ever-Changing Shore, all about nature and ecology of life, she started to become very disturbed about the use of synthetic chemical pesticides after World War II. And so from her bio, she reluctantly changed her focus to start warning the public about long-term effects of misusing pesticides, which turned into her book Silent Spring, where she challenged the practices of agricultural scientists and called for change that basically saved humankind from the dangers of pesticides at that time. And of course, it wasn't just this easy, you know, I'm going to write this book and the world will become informed and all things will change. Because of course not. Nothing works that way. There's always resistance and pushback. And she was attacked by the chemical industry. She was dismissed as an alarmist. She kept speaking out courageously about this issue. And it really, again, was not her forte. She was not someone who set out to do this. But her work changed the world. And What worked for Rachel Carson, and I don't know why I can't say her name, is that she had the gift of being able to write. She could express herself that way. So she took that gift and was able to translate it onto a bigger stage. We also have the work of Aaron Brockovich, who was a legal clerk and went on to be a successful environmental activist, right? Remember the movie with Julia Roberts? And she fought PG&E and won, and she's gone on to have a long environmental activist career and done very well. And here's another person that was, you know, a mom and trying to raise her children and trying to get by in a tough economic times, and finds herself being called into service by an entire community that she saw suffering and couldn't turn her back or turn away, and kept moving down this path till she spearheaded this great change. I think of the work of Mother Jones. She was a school teacher, a dressmaker. She was a wife and mother of four children. We've talked about her before around Labor Day. When she lost her family to illness, she went on to be a prominent labor and community organizer. She was at one time dubbed the most dangerous woman in America by the United States government. I mean, she probably would not have chosen this path. Her preference would have been to raise her children and be a part of her family and teach school and make dresses. But because of things that shifted in her life, she found herself on this very public stage and made a huge difference. And then from a national and world influence, we can look at smaller community changes that have happened just locally in this area. And I was thinking about that as I was riding my bike the other day out from AG into Avila Beach. And of course, I got onto the Bob Jones Trail. And Bob Jones Bike Trail, you know, was inspired by just a local environmentalist. And it's the thing that's interesting is that I had a hard time finding a lot of information on Bob Jones' background. But what I did find that he was a local environmental pioneer dedicated to protecting natural habitats. He worked for California Department of Fish and Wildlife for 23 years. He retired to Avila Valley in 1983. He was the president of the Land Conservancy from 1988 to 1991. And he was passionate about protecting San Luis Obispo Creek, and hence this bike trail was named in his honor. We also have the Dinosaur Caves Project, which was an open space area in Pismo that was slated to be commercially developed for years and years, and the work of local citizens were able to protect that area, retain the open space, and put in this beautiful park. And now most recently we have Pismo Preserve, and that was also thanks to the work of citizens who came together and took action and stood up for this wild open space that wasn't going to be able to speak for itself. And then finally, when we look at these calls to change, I recently saw the movie Joy with Jennifer Lawrence. Great movie. And it's funny because I dragged my husband, Chris, to the movie with me. And it wasn't total drag. You know, he was up for let's go see a film, and he really likes popcorn. So we went to the movie, and I think he was expecting it to be chick flick, but we both agreed at the end that it was just a really well done, solid story. So I highly recommend it. But the thing that stood out for me was here was this young woman, Joy Mangano, who was really struggling economically. She came from a family, a working class family, Italian American family that had struggled for, you know, a couple generations. There were four generations that were intermingled together in their lives, trying to kind of help each other just to survive, to keep a roof over their head, to, you know, have an income, to keep people healthy. I mean, this family was really struggling through across the generations, from grandparents down to her children. And she, well, I don't know if I want to give it away because I might give away the story. So, just she goes on to be the founder of a business dynasty that changes the course of her family's life. And that was really the point that I sat in this movie so inspired, because I think there are a lot of ways that we as ordinary people make huge changes. Because imagine now, and I don't know her family story since this happened, but I would imagine that the course of the next seven generations of her family have been changed because she was able to provide them with more economic security and more opportunities. And the thing that I found most admirable about her, and I think a lot of people would dismiss it as crazy, but even in light of her family's dysfunction, that there was a lot of adversaries within the family and people that were fighting each other inside and outside of the family, that she pretty much held tight to holding that family together the whole time through, better or worse, grandparents, exes, parents. She held everyone together in this really strong, steely way that I think benefits the whole family in the long run. So it was interesting. So here we are with all these different ways that we can make change, inspire change in the world. And I'm wondering what you've got inside of you that's burning to come out. Is there something that you're passionate about? What calls you? I don't know. I'm curious to know. 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You know, I think one of the reasons that this topic sticks out for me, and it's probably each week, right? It's something that's resonating with me, something that's going on in my life. And anyone who knows me knows that I get very excited and passionate about different causes and issues and want to speak out about them. And maybe it's great that I have this opportunity every Tuesday. But the downside about having this opportunity to learn about new issues or new concerns or different areas that need attention is that I have a hard time committing myself to that one passion, right? To that one cause. I get too excited and want to follow too many shiny objects. And I think that's what really separates those who go on to make change successfully and a lot of us who just get really soapboxy about issues, right? Can get up on that soapbox and really let it rip, but then there's no follow through. And I think that's the thing I wanted to explore today is, can we all find that inner activist, right? Do we all have the ability to really follow through on something that matters to us? And it has a lot to do with something else, and I think we talked about it last week, was the idea of the hero's journey, which was first introduced by Joseph Campbell in his book, Hero of a Thousand Faces. And the hero's journey is this mythological story of how an ordinary person goes off and faces a great challenge or goes on a great adventure and transforms their life in profound ways and then returns back to their life a new person. And I think what we see in people who are activists is someone who has been pulled into a hero's journey. And again, as I mentioned earlier, most often those who go off on a hero's journey do so reluctantly. There's very few people who say, yes, I want to be challenged, send me off so I can be incredibly uncomfortable. I'm going to take this hero's journey. But the hero's journey has very specific steps to it, and they all are steps that follow the actions of a successful activist. The first one, and it's a term that Martin Luther King Jr. talked about in his biography, was that, you know, his primary commitment in life was to be a preacher of the gospel. He remained committed to sharing that throughout his lifetime. But he knew from a very early age that he had the inner urge to serve humankind, that there was a calling in him on a deep and profound level that he knew. And so from the hero's journey perspective, there is a call to action because something has occurred. Rachel Carlson, I can't even say the name now, so I don't know why I've got the hang of it in my head, but Ms. Carson felt the call because she could see the damage being done by these toxins. And so she's called to action, just as Aaron Brockovich and Mother Jones, and I would imagine Bob Jones of the Bob Jones Bike Trail, called to action because something has occurred that they can't ignore. And once they move out on this journey, there's a few things that happen along the way. The first is accepting the call, because a lot of us will get passionate about something. We'll hear the calls like, oh, I really should do something about this. I really want to be a part of it. But we ignore the call, right? We don't want to be pulled out of our comfort zone or things are in the way of us moving forward. Or maybe we don't believe we actually have what it takes to do much about this issue. We can just get upset about it. But for those who move forward and complete the hero's journey, or those who take their activism and do something with it, they accept the call. And once they accept the call, they can't turn back. They're on this journey wherever it's going to take them. And so now along this hero's journey, it requires a lot of steely resolve and focus, because every hero is faced with challenges that are going to throw them off, that are going to challenge their deepest feelings about themselves, that are going to make life deeply uncomfortable. And fortunately, when the hero stays with their call to action, they're usually met by guides, right? Their own Yodas, someone who has wisdom or has energy to help them along the way, to give them whatever that is that they need to move forward a few more steps. And so that's the beauty of the hero's journey, that if we look around, there is always support for our cause. There are others that feel the same way. Our job, though, is to pull that support together. Because again, having a great idea alone is not as powerful as being able to pull the support together. So as the hero pulls together support of those who are wiser or who bring other skills and moves along the path, they learn to tolerate the discomfort. They learn to tolerate the inconvenience of what their life is like now that they're trying to make change or move an idea forward or see something to the end. And the thing that's interesting about the hero's journey is that it rarely happens in a day or a week or even a month. I mean, Martin Luther King spent over 20 years, 1946, he wrote his first letter to the editor, and he was working until 1968. Everyone who sees something huge to be resolved takes many, many years. So you have to have the investment of time. But if the hero sticks with it, after they've completed this journey, they've passed through all the challenges, they found their guides, they find their lives transformed permanently, and they move back into their old life in new and profound ways, as new people. And that comes with challenges itself. But we're going to talk about that in a little bit. I just wanted to introduce this idea that we all have that ability to follow the hero's journey. The first key is figuring out what is calling you to action. 805-781-3875. And I'd like to welcome Shelley Higginbotham to the program. Shelley, thank you for calling in, because I know I last minute called you.
No problem, and I apologize. I'm in my car. I am hands-free, but you'll mind through the windshield wipers going back and forth.
Well, I just was hoping you, because I touched briefly on how inspired every time I ride by Dinosaur Caves I am by the community's ability to protect this land that was scheduled to be commercialized. And now it's open for everyone. And it occurred to me that there's a lot of people who probably have no idea how this happened and probably don't know that the mayor of Pismo Beach was one of the integral people to make this happen.
Well, not really. No. When you talk about heroes, you want to talk about, first and foremost, the city council that had the leadership to say this should be a park and not a hotel, and that it was very controversial. This is in the mid to late 80s, and people knew that Pismo lived and died on transient occupancy taxes. So they took a lot of heat, but they stayed strong and knew that it was going to be a fantastic place for the community. And so once that decision was made, Carolyn Johnson, who was our senior planner, worked with the city, and they put together the Dinosaur Caves Task Force. And there were about 35 individuals from throughout the community in Pismo Beach that got together to work to come up with a vision for that property, which is phenomenal.
And it was not a short period of time, right? It took like 16 years from idea to inception, correct?
Oh, correct, because they really didn't want it to be, quote, a drain on city revenues, and they wanted to do it correctly. They wanted to make a park that wasn't like any ordinary park, so that's why you have the overlooks, and you have passive equipment so the kids can be more interpretive. And so as part of that, the Dinosaur Caves Preservation Society was formed, and then this incredible woman, Marilee Hyman, came out, and she really was the workhorse and put her heart and soul into the vision of the park, and she coordinated donations for tiles and benches, and I mean, she and her husband have done a phenomenal job. And as you see, every time you drive by, it's a testimony to what, if people really get together and they're interested in making something happen, it can happen.
And so what does it take, though, to keep moving forward in the face of resistance, right? Because a lot of people wanted it to be developed, and a lot of citizens didn't want the city to pay. So how did you and the others in your group, how did you keep fighting and saying, okay, I'm going to spend another 3 weeks or another year, and your family probably saying, Mom, why are you still doing this? You know, how did you stick with that?
Well, it's, again, I think as you talk about, you find that passion and you have that vision for something, and you know at the end of the day that people are maybe a little bit afraid and they don't realize the benefits. I think we get into silos and we think that things need to be a certain way. And if somebody comes in and says, well, no, I have a different idea that's a polar opposite of what other people think should happen, it's somewhat scary and intimidating, and so you have to just steer the course and continue with your vision and how great it's going to be. And that's when you enlist all of the people that share the same vision as you, mm-hmm. and you get as many people involved and say, this is going to be a great thing. And you begin to not convince, but you begin to bring some of the individuals that are not on board yet to see the bigger picture.
Well, and it sounds like, and it seems kind of the key to all of these big movements or even small movements or even talking about change within the family, that there has to be someone who holds the vision and someone who has the ability to excite other people, right? That it takes both. It takes someone with that visionary ability to speak about it or write about it and excite people, and then it takes all the people who are willing to come on board and follow that vision. It's like...
Right.
So do you...
And that's why I went back to that city council back in those days. I know it was John Brown and Marion Mello, and I apologize because I know I'm forgetting someone else. And they were the majority, and they had that vision, and they stayed the course because they truly believed this was going to be a great place for the community, and they didn't waver. And they continued to send that message and continued to engage more people in the community so that it really did become a community vision and a community effort. And that makes a difference.
Absolutely. And I'm glad we got to talk about it because there are a lot of worthy projects up and down the Central Coast and the state of California and all over that could be moved forward with just a small vision that turns into a big idea. And to have this example is great inspiration.
And look at the Pismo Preserve.
Yes.
Holy smokes.
Yes.
I mean, that was a miracle, and it took such energy and leadership from the Land Conservancy to be able to raise that amount of money in such a short time. And look what we have now.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mayor Higginbotham, for taking the time to call today.
Mr. Walton, great topic, Elizabeth. Great job.
Drive carefully, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're talking about what it takes to inspire change. Are you someone who has the charisma to get an idea out there and to get people on board and excited? Are you someone who gets excited about someone who has a wonderful idea and wants to work on that project? What is that? What drives you? What is your passion? That's what we're talking about today. And what about that hero's journey? Because as I mentioned before, the hero's journey is not a comfortable journey. You know, it's not riding in the luxury car. It is a lot of struggle. It comes at a cost. Whenever we choose to devote ourselves to any sort of cause or issue or change, it's a cost to not only our own lives and comfort, but also to our family, to those who count on us, to our day-to-day mental health and well-being, that it takes a large bit of sacrifice in order to bring about change. So when we think about these people who've put their lives out there to make a difference in their family, in their community, and in their country, it did not just happen alone. It came at a cost to their personal lives, to their family's lives, but it also came with great rewards, I would imagine, emotionally, spiritually. So I'm curious to know what you think about this idea. 805-781-3875. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to KCBX FM. And Charlie, what's on your mind?
Okay. Well, one thing I, I'm glad to hear that, because as a kid, I remember seeing that half-finished Brontosaurus out there, and I actually took the elevator down to the cave when it was a commercial attraction. What I want to talk about is, I just got out of a committee from our church, Valley of the Flowers Church, we're on the sixth annual Lompoc Peace Prize Committee. What we do is we pick, we have selected around 10 people who've contributed to peace and understanding in the Lompoc area, and we're recognizing them on the Sunday the 31st. It's a privilege to recognize things. I also am on the Native Plant Society statewide volunteer recognition committee. So I've had the privilege of being able to nominate and recognize some of these local heroes.
And when you talk about the Peace Prize in Lompoc, can you give me one or two examples of work that has been nominated?
Okay. We've had the our recent police chief who's contributed a lot. The lady that really went out of the way to promote the North County Rape Crisis Center, people that have done big and little things, and it's a tough decision sitting and looking at this. There's Pastor Doug wound up there's an episode where there was a homeless shelter they completely cleaned out. It kind of folded, and this man took upon himself to open up his church and school for these. In fact, he wound up having some bushes in front of his house burned, and he was I think a couple years ago an awardee. We've had I tell you, it's a tough decision.
Yeah.
Going through all these people that have done so much.
Well, and I appreciate you calling in, Charlie, because I imagine, you know, there are so many ways that people are giving on a daily basis, and it's great that we have these places to acknowledge their contributions, because I think it inspires others to try to get their word out or speak about the things they believe in. And when we talk about that hero's journey, you know, there seems to always be resistance and pushback, and that might be another thing that separates those who actually get the change through or get their cause heard or right the injustice, and those who have a great idea but never really get off the soapbox and make it happen, is because it can be frightening to face the resistance that comes when we propose change. It can be frightening to face the pushback from a strong bureaucracy or a government who doesn't want anything to be different. And so you have to have an incredible amount of inner resilience in order to face that resistance and pushback. And quite often, I don't know how many of us have that courage to stand up to criticism in that way. It takes a hero's soul. But I do think it's something that we can develop. I think we all have that ability. And I really wanted to talk to this next guest into the show today, Anna Lenart. Anna is an AmeriCorps Vista alum and founder of The Next Generation of Service, which is an online alternative career center aimed at helping young people launch their career with a year of service. Anna is also a fellow ambassador of mine with the Franklin Project. But I really wanted to invite Anna to be on the air today to talk about her journey to service, but also founding her own nonprofit, and how has that journey been for you? Anna, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So how did you go from being, I didn't say that you started off as a college student at Carnegie Mellon, mm-hmm. and when you got to your junior year or after junior year, you felt something wasn't right and you were having some call to action or an inner urge for something different or some sort of pull away from your path that you were on. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about where that led you and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah. So I was studying engineering and I was going to use engineering to solve all the world's problems. I was really excited about that. And I think I learned really fast that you know, alternative energy, all of these innovations that engineering was applied to were very much operating in, you know, business, and they were aimed at profit. While they were also trying to solve problems, they were also aimed at profit. And so I became a little bit disillusioned, like a young idealistic 20-something can become sometimes. And I decided to take a year off of undergrad, and I really saw it as a year off. I was like, I'm going to, you know, take a break. And I ended up doing AmeriCorps, and I ended up in AmeriCorps Vista, which is like capacity building for a nonprofit. And I got placed at a women's recovery center here in San Diego called Shop D Rising. And it was not a year off at all. You know, it was completely transformative and really let me use the skills I had that I had from school and put them into action, but also just learn so much about myself and learn about what happens that leads people into recovery. You know, I think, you know, I have kind of an upper middle class, relatively privileged background and hadn't really thought much about all the circumstances that lead someone into drugs and alcohol and abuse. And so that really opened my mind to kind of the systemic issues we have in this country. And I knew I wanted to solve those. But then I got back to school and really noticed a lot of my peers in a similar situation. Like, I don't know where I want to work. I have this degree. I want to solve problems. And I just don't know how to start my career. And they didn't know what AmeriCorps was. Most of them had never heard of AmeriCorps. Some of them had heard of Peace Corps, but knew they didn't want to go abroad. So I knew right then that there was a serious issue, and we had these really talented people who couldn't find jobs or weren't sure how they wanted to start their career and were feeling really lost. And that service would really give them the empathy and perspective that they were looking for, I think, on a deep level, and also let them feel like they're making a difference. So that was sort of the start, and then kind of back to your hero's journey. You know, I got the calling and I was like, oh, this is going to be easy. This will be cool. I'm just going to start this website. We're going to pair recent grads with alumni of service year programs, and they're going to talk, and these young people are going to decide to add a year of service to the career path. It's not going to be that complicated. And of course, it's been challenging. It's been long. I started that when I was 24, and I'm almost 28 now, and I did not think it was going to take all of my 20s and like totally take me off of the engineering career path. But it did, and it's very clear to me now that this is going to be like a lifelong thing to try to create a world where every recent grad starts their career with service. So, but yeah, you can't really turn back, like you were saying.
And so what have been some of the compromises you've had to make in your own personal life to realize this vision for next generation of service?
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, it's been a big financial thing. I think that's true of probably a lot of activists. I graduated from Carnegie Mellon, like you mentioned, which has a reputation for having some of the highest opening salaries in the country. And I was offered a few of those with my degree. But, you know, decided to start my own nonprofit, which fundraising is really hard. Fundraising is especially hard for something like this, where it's not instant, right? The national service movement, you're not like giving $100 and then 6 months later there is a school in Africa with your name on it. That's just not how the national service movement works. You're investing in young people early in their career with the hope and the belief that they are going to become amazing leaders that put people on the planet before profit in whatever sector they end up in. And that's just not, you know, the sexiest thing to give to sometimes. So it's been really, you know, I've definitely taken a huge cut there. And then so all the stress that kind of comes with that and, you know, kind of the back of your mind, like, I don't have a 401k and what's going to happen when I have kids? And, you know, those beliefs start to kind of trickle in and you have to kind of push them out.
So you've had to delay some of those immediate goals for the longer term goal of seeing next generation of service. And as you said, you know, your generation adding to their, not taking away from their career path, but adding to their mm-hmm. career path by taking a year and giving to a nonprofit somewhere in the country, right? Giving back to the country through community service or a year of service. And AmeriCorps, mm-hmm. for those who don't know, why don't you give the brief description of what AmeriCorps is?
Yeah, definitely. So AmeriCorps at its core is actually a grant from the government. and it goes to fund the long-term service programs, which can range from anywhere from just being a person who is working at a nonprofit, almost like a staff member, which is what I did. So I was a development staff member for a whole year. So I was treated like staff. I was there full-time, but I was being paid a stipend by the government through this grant program. And then there's also more formal programs like City Year, which places long-term volunteers for 1 year in a school where they're doing mentoring and tutoring. And then there's other programs like Habitat for Humanity, where you're getting a stipend from the government for a year to work on building houses. So it's really any kind of position at a nonprofit or community organization or school. There's a lot at schools as well. And you're getting a stipend to kind of support you while you're volunteering, so you're not, going into debt. And then a lot of the AmeriCorps programs also come with $5,000 to go towards student loans, which is helpful as well.
At the end of your service.
Mm-hmm, right.
And what I understand is that the alum of AmeriCorps is quite a tight-knit group also, so that networking mm-hmm. with all of these people who shared a service year is quite powerful as you move into the private or public sector.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a tight network. There's also just so many skills. We were talking about this yesterday. The amount of responsibility a 22-year-old that started AmeriCorps is given versus the amount of responsibility a 22-year-old in a company at its opening position is just so drastically different. So you're just given way more responsibility, way more hats to wear, way more jobs to do. And so you come out with just a wide range of skill sets and just a clear understanding of what you like and what you don't like.
And probably makes you much more employable than in a corporate mm-hmm. setting if that's your ultimate path.
Exactly. And that's really what the Franklin Project, which you and I are a part of, and some of the other national players in this movement are trying to really make sure corporations understand this, that this is like a great person to have on your team. They care about their communities, and they have a wide range of skills, and they can operate with small budgets, they're creative, all of these things.
So any regrets on the path you've been on?
Oh, absolutely not. I still occasionally, I do a little bit of consulting and freelance work and stuff like that with my engineering degree. And it's so striking how amazing the people in the national service movement are and just how fun they are to work with compared to my general everyday people that I work with. So that alone, it's been worth it.
So if there are young people or parents who are interested in finding out more about national service and how it can help their career path, how can they get in contact with you for that alternative career center counseling that you offer?
Yeah, check out www.ngsmovement.org, and there are resources there for students who are looking to meet with one of our guides. Also tons of blog posts and information just on national service in general. And from there, you can also contact me. The contact form goes to me. And all of our Twitter handles and Facebook pages and stuff are up on that too. So,
Anna, thank you so much for following your calling and giving me the opportunity to get to know you.
Yeah, it's been great.
And
thanks for your work.
Thanks for calling in. And so if you want more information about the work that Anna's doing, if you feel the call to service of any kind, it's not just young people, 18 to 28, but also there's elder service. If you've gotten to a place in your career where you're ready to do something more with that, ngsmovement.org. Or if you Google national service, there's all sorts of different opportunities. But yeah, I think there is a huge piece of that hero's journey that comes along with anything we do that takes us off the path we think we're supposed to be on and directs us in a completely different place. And the transformation that happens, although it's wonderful, as I mentioned before, it does come at a cost because you return back to your life as you knew it before you leave on this journey, and you're no longer the same person. And you may find that your old life needs to also change in order for you to move forward, that some of the people in your life that you were close to before you won't connect with in the same way, or the way you lived your life day to day, or the things that were important to you will change. So it's important to understand that anything we do that we are passionate about will cause change to happen in positive and sometimes challenging ways. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can get in touch with us through our Facebook page, at our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or podcast our shows through iTunes. Love to have you be a part of this conversation. I think this topic is a large topic because we are passionate peoples. We all have things that we care deeply about. But I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on this. What calls you? What are you holding yourself back from, or what are you actually following through with? Janet, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind today? Hi there. Are you still there?
I am.
Hi. Thanks for waiting.
You're welcome.
So what brought you on? What made you decide to call in today?
I was sort of in a period in my life after retirement that I call my dormant period, and not involved in really any of the movements and or causes that I believe so deeply in. And that all changed when my daughter read an article on climate change after she had given birth. And she became so dedicated and inspired to work to do everything she could to prevent impending disaster that she got me involved also.
So what kind of, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What kind of work then did you found yourself doing? Where did it lead you?
It led us into gathering signatures on petitions and getting a ballot measure on the ballot and educating the public and meeting lots of wonderful people. We were not successful in the political movement, but in passing the Measure P, which we worked on, but we were successful in educating the public and in getting a lot of people involved and in continuing to do everything we can to protect the environment. So even people who haven't done any of this before can find their way. And it's very humbling and exciting all at the same time.
And how do you find the resilience to move forward when you face the resistance or pushback against something that you know in your core is so important? How do you find that commitment to keep going?
Well, you know, there's a book called Active Hope, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it can help you kind of get up out of your chair and work on things even if they seem undoable. Mm-hmm. But also, once I have found that once I started, I got a great feeling of meaningfulness from other people who were involved. And so quitting wasn't really an option. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something, I mean, we do face a huge obstacles, but there's a lot of work and hope and effort that just keeps people involved, I think, at least for me.
So if we're following your hero's journey, you had this call to action. Your daughter was activated and kind of pulled you in. And so together you kind of have started walking this walk towards helping climate change or bringing about awareness. And you have met people along the way who've inspired you and kept you going, kind of those guides that heroes meet when they're just about to throw in the towel or give up on the journey, that support of others has helped kept you excited and
well,
helped.
And my grandchildren, you know,
okay.
If future generations are to have, you know, the same kinds of things that we had growing up in terms of open space and clean air and clean water and all of that, then, you know, this is a journey that we can't really bow out of,
yeah.
You know.
And it is not a short-term commitment, which I think is hard for a lot of people, that this change isn't going to happen in a year or 5 years or 10 years, that people have to be committed to it for the long haul. And we tend to be a culture that doesn't do great with the long haul on any sort of idea.
Right.
Thank you for taking the time to call in, Janet, and I appreciate your hard work.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're talking about those things we're passionate about, being called on a hero's journey, wanting to make a difference in an area of our lives, whether it's helping our family's future or doing something for the community or maybe something on a national scale that you feel committed to or passionate about. What is that that drives you? And how will you approach your hero's journey? Because as I keep mentioning, the hero's journey is not an easy path. It might be fun to volunteer for a day at something or a week to be a part of a different event or 6 months even. But when we talk about a hero's journey, we're talking about leaving our life as we know it, the comfort of our life as we know it. Or maybe our life has become kind of rutted and routine and we are ready to leave that life as we know it. But the minute we step out of our known world and start on a new path, it does come with a change that can be uncomfortable. And it requires a lot of steely resolve and focus and resilience and the ability to tolerate a lot of discomfort and inconvenience. Those young people who go off and do their service years for AmeriCorps and Teach for American City Year, they're given a very small stipend and they're living below the poverty level. And they have to be able to deal with this discomfort and be resilient and figure out their way through it. But in the end, that support, those people that come to us along the way that inspire our lives, you know, make that journey become kind of intoxicating. A lot of people on a hero's journey find it difficult to go back to their old lives because it starts to become exciting to be a part of something that energizes you, that connects you to something that gives you a sense of purpose. But ultimately, the hero's journey draws us back to our life as it once was. And then we are faced with either fundamentally changing our life forever from that point, changing the people we're with, changing the things that we do, or we kind of settle back into our life as it was until that next call comes. So where are you with this? 805-781-3875. Hi, Sean. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was the guy that did the appeal for the development, against the development of Pirates Cove, and we won that particular thing. I don't know what I can contribute, but I've had some thoughts while I've been listening to you talk, and I just think it's a really interesting topic.
So tell me a couple of those thoughts that you've had.
Well, you asked how you started on the thing. For me, it started in Denver when I lived there. I loved the outdoors, and I would go to places around Denver, and inevitably, you know, even miles and miles outside of Denver, you come to fences, you come to signs, you come, you know, this place is only open between these hours and that hours and everything. And I would drive 500 miles to get to desert, someplace that was unregulated and wild and open. And when I got here, I could not believe that Pirates Cove was pristine, relatively unregulated, just dirt and rock and raw ocean, and I absolutely fell in love with the place. And it was not, you know, 6 months after I arrived that somebody said to me, well, what we're going to do is we're just going to shut it down. We're going to shut it down at night. That was the first thing that I heard. And what that said to me immediately was, you're taking away the rights of thousands of other people, just callously, just disregard anybody, whatever, what anybody else wants to do, the freedom that they have, you're going to take it from them. And that immediate injustice was what started me on that path. And then I heard more and more about development, and there's cement, and, you know, there's going to be hours, and there's going to be, we're going to put signs everywhere, and all of this. And it was just, you know, they're turning this, they're taking this bit of wild, beautiful place, and they're going to develop it and turn it into, you know, another processed, pasteurized nature experience. And that was just, I just thought, please think about what you're doing, because once you pave it, it's paved, and that'll be it forever.
So, Sean, I'm sorry, because I have to cut you a little short. If people feel the passion you do for preserving this open space, who do they contact?
I think you have to do it yourself, and I think that you have to be driven to do it yourself. In this case, we appealed it to the Board of Supervisors. The Board of Supervisors denied our appeal twice, so then we went to the Coastal Commission, and specifically in those cases, anything near the coast, you can appeal to the Coastal Commission.
So it sounds like it takes an individual having this passion to get the conversation started, whether it's in the local government or the state government. And I think it's a great way to close it out today, to remind people that once you've had the call for something that you love, like open space, you can't shut your mind off to it. That can be a blessing or a curse. But the most important thing I think we're learning when it comes to activism, that even though technology is a wonderful way of bringing people together, it's really going to be about boots on the ground, people getting out and gathering together, marching together, meeting together in front of council members, in front of government agencies, that just merely signing petitions online is not going to do the work for change. We have to become people who show up in the places that demand our attention. And that's the thought I leave you with today. Thank you for supporting KCBX Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Go out and do good work.
Come.